Thanks very much, Jack. We'd now like to begin with panel one. If I could ask each of you to come up. I'd like to first, for those of you in doubt, we'll be putting out your name tags. If you recognize your name, please step forward. And I'd like to take this, this is always this moment of truth when we determine whether or not, one of the great things about this meeting is we have a number of very senior officials. One of the challenges about this meeting is that we hope a number of senior officials will come. So I think we are starting with something shorter than a quorum than we had anticipated. But I would first I'd like to introduce our moderator for this group. We're very grateful that Tom Khalil, who is, has agreed to be with us. As I think almost all of you know, he is the Deputy Director for Policy for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and he is also the Senior Advisor for Science, Technology, and Innovation for the National Economic Council. He's on leave from UC Berkeley, where he was Special Assistant to the Chancellor for Science and Technology. And while there, he is responsible for developing a number of major new multidisciplinary research and education initiatives at the intersection of information technology, nanotechnology, microsystems, and biology. Now, the good news is that Tom has agreed to come to the federal government and help do some of the same things. For those of you who don't know, he previously served as the Deputy Assistant to President Clinton for Technology and Economic Policy and the Deputy Director of the White House National Economic Council. Tom has, in that capacity, launched a number of important initiatives, and both professionally and personally, I'd like to express our thanks to Tom. The things that he did, like the National Technology Initiative and the Next Generation Internet, efforts to bridge the digital divide and increase e-learning, the funding streams that were launched then have largely continued and have continued to make major contributions to the advancement of science and to the advancement of the competitiveness of the United States economy. We have a genuine debt for this type of distinguished civil servant, and we're very pleased to have him here. He began his career here in Washington with Dewey Ballantyne, and Tom and I share something in common, which is the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which teaches you a little bit about everything, and you can stay in over your head for a long period in your life. So with that, I'd like to welcome Tom Khalil. Thanks very much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning, and I want to thank Chuck and the Academy for all the important work that they've done in terms of evaluating the SBIR program. We are going to be talking about, it looks like, the role primarily of DARPA this morning and the SBIR program. And after Ken talks, we're going to have Christina Johnson, who's the Undersecretary for Energy, and Al Schaefer, who's the Principal Deputy Director for DDR&E, which has responsible within the Defense Department for the overall coordination of the defense S&T. Ken is a great person to address this topic because he's really been involved in a number of different aspects of the innovation ecosystem at Bell Labs, where he was one of the pioneering researchers in areas like MEMS, and then he was at DARPA in the 1990s, or as those of us in the Clinton administration say, those dark days of peace and prosperity. Then played a very important role at DARPA in the 90s as the principal champion for MEMS. I think because when you got back from a sabbatical at Japan, someone had like taken away your lab space or something like that. Is that right?
Pretty much.
and then did a stint in the private sector as a founder of Acoustica, a MEMS-based startup working on MEMS digital microphones for consumer electronics applications. And so really had the real-world experience involved in commercializing something and trying to make something that people want to buy. And has graciously agreed to come back into public service and is now deputy director of DARPA. And he and Regina Dugan are just doing a fantastic job at DARPA. So we're glad you could take some time away from that important responsibility and talk about how DARPA views the SBIR program, and also some of the changes that you're making in terms of how you administer the program, but how you use SBIR as a tool.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. I thought I'd start by giving you a very quick look at DARPA, for those of you who don't know DARPA, and then very quickly segue into how we're applying what we believe to be the strengths and core competencies of DARPA to the SBIR program at DARPA, informed by what we believe to be that strength, but also informed both by my experience and the director's experience, and obviously collectively thinking about what could best be done with the SBIR program to advance innovation and small business entrepreneurship. So I'm not sure whether I have control or not, but thank you. And got it. Thanks. So a lot of the culture of DARPA is really about creating and preventing strategic surprise, or as we like to describe it, as breaking old rules and making new ones. And you'll see we're applying some of that to the SBIR program. What I mean by we is DARPA was one of many reactions to Sputnik back in 1958. President Eisenhower said, don't let this happen again, and created an agency to make sure that we would not be strategically surprised again. And part of that, as some of you who know me know, that I'm a frustrated historian. So the reason DARPA was created as an agency that reported directly to the Secretary of Defense was what most people don't realize is the Army had the rocket that could have easily put a satellite up into space well before Sputnik. The Navy had the electronics for the satellite. And that's precisely the problem. The Army had the rockets and the Navy had the electronics. And so we were specifically formed to be overarching across all the services. The other things that are very important about DARPA is we are capability mission focused. As Dr. Gansler mentioned, they're depending on which sort of agencies you deal with. There are some that are focused on just funding research in specific technology areas. The hallmark of DARPA is we get in and out of areas. And we get in and out of areas by focusing on mission capabilities as opposed to funding specific technologies. The other is we take a very multidisciplinary approach, or if you want to think about it a different way, we don't care who is performing the work. It can be universities, it can be individual investigators, it can be small businesses, it can be big companies, defense companies. The objective and the capability is what's important, not who the performers are. And creating these multidisciplinary, multifaceted communities is really one of the hallmarks of the projects and programs at DARPA. So what comes out of that is frankly a history, a 50-year plus demonstrated capability to not only prevent strategic surprise but to create it. Everything from stealth to predator, and as Tom was kind enough to mention, MEMS. And one of the things that's really important to point out is the wisdom of President Eisenhower setting up DARPA to be completely independent of the services. Because one of the things that the director and I talk about DARPA being is in a collaborative competition with the services, in the sense that sometimes we work together with the services, but many times we also are in competition and do things that upset them and make them angry. And The UAV is a classic example. Airplanes without pilots, as you might imagine, was received with not a lot of love by the Air Force, right, when it was first mentioned in the 80s. And it was considered heresy to even think about it. But now the two wars that we are in could not be done without the UAVs that we have ongoing. So the reason I'm setting that up is to be kind to me as I explain to you some of the things that we're proposing to do in the SBIR program. We're driven by, and this is true about all of our performers, especially so by the SBIRs. I want to build on this notion of the importance of getting money quickly. For us to be able to do what we do, we have to get the best jumpers. If you're going to make the creative leaps that prevent and create strategic surprise, you need the best performers. You need the best program managers. You need to attract the best talent, the best companies. And one thing I would point out as we think about SBIR programs are not just the people that have gotten funds from SBIRs to date, but who have not. Who did we never even see come to the SBIR programs because they stayed away from federal funding? The other is timeliness. If we don't quickly take advantage of proposals, if we don't quickly put people under contract, then you lose the fragile and the fleeting nature of the opportunities and performance. So when we came to DARPA late last summer, we looked at the SBIR program and made a number of changes, all focused on essentially doing these three things: better connecting the SBIR performers to the ongoing programs at DARPA. So as all of you know, SBIR programs are a 2.5% tax on existing R&D and S&T programs. Generally, they tend to be at the edges of what happens in an agency. So we wanted to take steps to make them more connected to what was going on in the programs. We did that by actually doing something that might seem counterintuitive. We actually sent out fewer topics for our SBIR solicitations. And we did that very consciously, because what was tending to happen was everybody was submitting topics, and the tendency was to peanut butter the SBIR dollars across those topics, so you had subcritical performers in almost every single category. And we didn't think that was the right way to foster the sort of growth of a small company into someone performing at full potential. So what we did was actually take fewer topics and insisted that they be better connected to the ongoing programs. Let me just give you one quick example. We had a major initiative in a new type of photolithography system as part of one of the microelectronics technology programs. And this was tens of millions of dollars to come up with a new approach to lithography that would extend existing generation photolithographic tools so that they could do N plus one generation density by restricting and controlling some of the patterns that were generated in the electronics. Came up with new design tools, new equipment, and the program was developing these but didn't really have a way to test whether these tools were going to be useful in creating new circuits. So what we did was work with that program manager and create an SBIR topic where the small businesses, and now roughly about 20 to 30 of them with the dollars that we carved out, one single topic dedicated about $5 to $10 million of our SBIR dollars to have small businesses use the new CAD tools, use the new photolithography tool to develop and build circuits. What that did was take that $10 or $20 million investment in photolithographic tools and actually have the SBIR program and SBIR performers use those tools, exercise them, and that was a benefit both to the program that was developing those tools because they got an instant 20 to 30 users, and the SBIR performers got access to advanced technology that they might not otherwise have. The other is what I will call better alignment for access to venture capital and private investment. So one of the tendencies that we also saw when we looked at our contracting shop and looked at the contracts that were being let, and I mean looked at, like I sat down with our contracting officers, show me a phase one and a phase two SBIR contract. They were that thick. And they had all sorts of regulations in there that, frankly, you know, out of, I don't think out of any particular evil, but just out of habit, were in the SBIR contract. They were crushing the small companies. So what we did was sit down and actually several times back and forth. It took a few cycles, and said, and I told them, if it's not required by law, get rid of it. Honestly, there, half the things in there were just things in there that were there out of inertia. I'll give you another example. There were a set of requirements for reporting that had to do with accounting, a set of requirements that had to do with IP rights and data rights reporting, and a third one for reporting progress on the program itself. The problem was they weren't aligned. And so if you lined them all up, in the course of a one-year contract, you had reporting almost every month in any one of those categories. So you were spending more time reporting than actually doing. So we got rid of everything that wasn't required by law. We got simplified the reporting, simplified the data rights and IP language so they didn't sound like the government was going to own everything you created, and just beginning to communicate with the private sector community, so that investment community, so that it wasn't scary, so that you didn't create two different types of companies. Both those two elements there, and including the third one, where better access to the awarded funds, the focus of simplifying the contracts was really to get the money out faster. To Dr. Gansler's point, and as an entrepreneur who grew a company and ultimately sold it, the most important thing is getting money, period, and meeting payroll, right? And there's nothing more harmful to a fragile and fleeting nature of putting a company together or getting business than not getting your money for 6 to 7 to 9 months after you've been awarded it. So when we looked at the statistics, we saw that the average time for award was about 5 to 6 months after we had selected them for award. So we targeted, that's going to change. You're going to award these in less than 60 days, whether it's a simplified contract or being able to use our particular authorities, which aren't unique. Other agencies have them, other transaction agreements. Not forcing people to do other transactions, but giving them the options to. And to date, we started posting in the Obama administration's transparency of government spirit. We started posting who was eligible for other transaction agreements on our website. To date, we've had 8 people be eligible. We've actually awarded 3 OTs, and the average days to award has been 26 days. So we're gone from about 5 to 6 months to less than a month for people who are capable of matching that. You can consider this a beta test, if you will. I'm a product engineer, so I don't rush things out until I test them. But now this has been tested, and it's out. And this is really the core of what we consider to be critical to making SBIRs more relevant. Simplify the contracts, get them out faster, get them the funds that they need faster, not only for the companies that are coming to us, but so that we can reach out to companies that we don't even know we're missing. Because I can tell you there are companies out there that never even approached the SBIR program, and that's a shame. Thanks.
Just one quick follow-up question before we go to Christine, and that is that you're also involved in some efforts to try to diffuse some of these promising practices more broadly throughout the government.
Right. So as part of the NSTC, we've put together a working group of folks from a variety of different agencies, NIST, NIH, Department of Agriculture, DARPA, DOD, to compare and share best practices. And we've actually begun to apply some of these, and we're learning some things from others. In fact, for example, like a phase one and phase two joint submission, so you don't have to wait for a phase two submission after you get your phase $1. That's right.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, we're fortunate to have Dr. Christina Johnson, who is the Undersecretary for Energy at the Department of Energy. And Christina joins us from Johns Hopkins University, where she was provost. And she's also been Dean of Engineering at Duke and founder of a number of startups, particularly in the photonics space. Yeah. So great to see you, Christina.
Good to see you too, Tom. Thanks very much for the opportunity to share some of the things that we're doing at DOE with regard to the SBIR program as well. And we are also participating on the interagency panel with Dr. Gabriel, and very much appreciate your leadership in what you just described and what you're doing. So you'll see some similar threads in what we've been trying to do. Well, I guess the main topic, I'm going to echo something Dr. Gabriel just said, and that is what do entrepreneurs need? They need flexibility, but they need money. You know, and my mentor, who is Juan Rodriguez, who started Storage Tech, IBM executive, and Storage Tech and Exabyte, and other sorts of companies in the Boulder area, said, you know, doing a startup is like being in a war, and running out of money is like running out of bullets. And that is so true. So I think that some of the things that we're looking at, too, is trying to give these companies staying power. And that's really the theme of my remarks. Just to put it into context of our SBIR program in the broader view of the Department of Energy, this is the portfolio of the Office of the Undersecretary for Energy, and it's approximately $10.4 billion, of which $6 billion is for environmental management and cleanup. And so of the $10.4 billion, there's roughly $4.4 billion in some areas of R&D. And so one of the first things that I discovered was not very clear what was considered to be R&D, and therefore subject to the 2.8% tax, 2.5% for SBIR and 0.3% for STTR. And I don't like to use the word tax, you know, just, but anyway, I haven't found
allocation.
A better word.
Allocation.
Allocation. Okay, allocation. Thank you. I knew that I would. No. That wasn't to call you out. But I think that there's one of the issues that I have seen, I'm not sure if this is, I think it's true, is that we can't use any of that 2.8% allocation to manage the program. So that's really tough, which means, and that's caused some of the symptoms of some of the things I'm going to talk about, which we're working on improving. So the President's budget for FY11 will have a 22% increase in solar energy, 53% increase in wind, increases in geothermal, and then, of course, the nuclear loan guarantee. Then we announced the first conditional ones about a month ago. And I mention this because the interesting thing is, along with the base budget, which is in the top, we have the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding. And what that allowed us to do was to take the 2.8% allocation from the ARRA funding and run a beta test of how we might change the SBIR program. And so I'm going to talk about some of the results there. And I agree, Dr. Gabriel, as an engineer, we are fortunate to have ARRA so that we could learn some things in real time quickly so that we could then change our base program. So that's what we're in the process of doing now. Now, where do all these various ARA funding and the loan guarantees and the SBIR program and the Energy Frontier Research Centers, or EFRCs, the hubs, all fit in? And so I've adopted past year's quadrant here to think about, in terms of a commercialization sense, this is from Don Stokes' book, Past Year's Quadrant. So on an XY graph, you might look at the kinds of investments we're making in the near term in order to reach the President's goal of building this clean energy economy, energy security, and greenhouse gas emission reduction, and then the longer term. And then also along the X-axis, looking at more fundamental discovery versus application. And so I'd sort of place the SBIR program sort of here. It's nearish term, you know, usually the phase one and phase two are 1 to 3 years. Of course, phase three or the commercialization program could extend that staying power to 5 years. So I put it sort of in the lower part of halfway through this sort of transition. These sorts of programs are 5 years, can be renewed for 5 years. Hubs are 5 years, could be renewed for 5 years. And then our core programs, program R&D. And then ARPA-E is out here looking for kinds of breakthroughs in technology that can really move the needle, move the slope in terms of driving technology to lower cost, therefore scaling the adoption. So in terms of loan guarantees, they're more in the applicationary pilots and demos. But SBIR really fills a nice hole in the program, and we want to make sure that we execute it well because, as we'll see later on, it is a $154 million a year program in DOE. This is just graphically showing you some of how we're trying to understand the Recovery Act funding and split it up between R&D, deployment, and others, other being loan guarantees and program enhancements. So, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but I always like to remind everyone that small business innovation really has driven the innovation in this country, to overstate it maybe a little bit, over the last 20 years. And it's quite interesting, right? So small businesses created 64% of the net new jobs, 14.5 million, or about 2,600 jobs per day. And, you know, obviously it's talent. And what I would like about the small business is if you create an entrepreneurial environment in your industry or in the university, both of those are not exactly grown to support the innovative entrepreneur. Large companies, if you've read the book, which I found quite interesting, The Innovator's Dilemma by Clay Christensen, it talks about companies that died because they couldn't innovate from within, and companies that were large that survived is because they would innovate outside and then bring them in, which was his basic thesis there. And the same with universities. You know, our mission in a university, and I've spent 25 years in them, is to educate, to train, and to pass on culture to the next generation. Now, I happen to believe that entrepreneurship is definitely ingrained in our culture. And before I taught at Duke, we might have called it Yankee ingenuity. Now I call it American ingenuity. But how do we do that translation, you know, from the university in the large sort of entities whose focus is here to then capture the innovation? And I think that's where the SBIR program comes in. So, you know, a lot of professors would rank their ability to be successful on how many students they placed at great academic institutions. And of my 18 PhD students I graduated, I think 16 started companies. I'm not sure what that means, but we went in a different direction. And so I want to talk a little bit about their path as well. So the current three-phase SBIR program in DOE would be looking at, you know, phase one, verifying a concept. That was $100K and lasted about 9 months for phase one. The phase two would be prototype development, and that ended up being up to $750K, but the average award was really more between the $500K and $700K, with a $250K phase two supplemental and some technology assistance program. And then we really didn't do phase three, although maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was a very interesting program called the Commercialization Advancement Program, or CAP. And we want to bring that back a little bit. So this is where it was. And, of course, the National Academy did a great study with the National Research Council on the SBIR program. And I read the book and the report. And from that informed how we did this pilot program, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Just say a little bit, Dr. Gabriel mentioned about topics. We had 60 topics all over the map, and I'm not sure that they mapped exactly to a strategic plan that we would have for energy. So I think there are some similarities there with what you were talking about. One of our great success stories, which we're very happy about, was that this is true story, of course. I wouldn't put it up if it wasn't, but MIT professor in 2001 started a company called A123 Systems, and they won a phase one in 2003 to develop lithium cathode materials for hybrid electric vehicles, batteries. They raised $20 million in a subsequent financing round after verifying the concept, the principle. They grew to $70 million a year in revenue, 1,700 employees, and went public this last fall. So, you know, the program was good. We just want to take it and make it great. And another success story, which I think is quite interesting, from the 90s, is that this was a company, SBM Atlantia. And so they were already an ongoing concern. They started with 10 employees in 1990. And in around about 1995, they wrote an SBIR to take their technology, which was building platforms that would be solidly anchored on the bottom in shallow water, so 50 to 200 feet, and then look at how they could go to offshore deep waters, 1,000 to maybe 4,000 feet, without anchoring, but have this sort of soft anchoring, if you will. And so they morphed a company from 10 employees and $10 million a year. They wanted to test out the technology. They wrote a phase one. They won on their first try. Wrote a phase two, from 95 to 98. They grew by 2007 to 600 employees and $300 million in revenue. And so when I think about this, when we invest in entrepreneurs, we're investing, you know, it's a little bit like the story, you know, you can teach someone to fish or you're going to feed them fish. You know, I think what we're doing is more on teaching to fish, because each one of those investments, invest in the right entrepreneur and they will create jobs for the rest of the country. And that's what we're seeing here. So you take a company with 10 employees, they were at a somewhat fragile phase. They didn't have a couple million dollars out of a $10 million a year revenue of all their potential income, if they were profitable, to put into R&D. So the idea is, can we supplement that along the way? And voila, we went from 10 employees to 600. We got an amplification of a factor of 60. That's the thing that we're looking to do. And also link it in with our R&D vision. So this is how the sources of funding were achieved. Is about $154.5 million tax, I mean allocation. And then the uses, interestingly enough, the Office of Science would generate on their 2.8% allocation about $104 million. They would actually use it on SBRs about $75 million, and a lot of that was transferred over to the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. But beyond that, really fossil energy and nuclear energy, the Office of Electricity, and the Office of Environmental Management. So Environmental Management is a $6 billion program, and yet it only generates about $900,000 in R&D funding for SBIR, because right now it doesn't have a heavy R&D program, which we're working on. So the idea is, it's kind of interesting. One of the criticisms, I think, or comments, I should say, in the National Academy report is it seemed to be somewhat siloed. You know, the programs that generated the money, then we're using them internally, and there was the recommendation that maybe we should go to a broader distribution and look for the opportunities. Well, at the same time, what we've been working on is a plan to try and figure out how do we get to the president's goals of 83% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. So we're looking at a curve here of our greenhouse gas emissions in 2010. The projections, EIA does a 25-year projection, so they'd go out to 2035. And then if you just extend that out to 2050, you could predict that our greenhouse gas emissions will grow from somewhere around 6 gigatons per year to about 7 gigatons per year. If we add in energy efficiency from the core programs, we feel we can bring that down considerably. And we're making the assumption here that our energy intensity, which has been steadily energy used per gross domestic product, has been dropping by minus 1.77 per year. If we can, or 1.8, let's say, if we can increase that to 2.2, we can actually get that savings in greenhouse gas emissions. So you might say, what could the SBIR program do there to get to scale? And then you have fuels. So from the entrance of biofuels as well as efficiency in just our transportation systems, you can get a little bit more. But it's clear we're going to need breakthroughs in scaling nuclear energy, carbon capture, sequestration, renewables, and offsets. So now that we have a very kind of detailed view of where our programs could contribute to the president's goals, we're now aligning that with all of our programs, including SBIR. Let's just give you some statistics. Phase one, we did about 1,700 phase one applications received. We saw that about 1,400 complied. So we're actually throwing out 300 reviews and going into the detail proposals to review and looking at the details. These were not proposals that were necessarily of poor quality. They were proposals that didn't fit the narrow topics. So what we discovered was our topics were very narrowly defined, and if it wasn't right within that topic area, it would get thrown out. So that seemed to me to be kind of high, 300 out of, you know, roughly, you know, it's about not quite 20%. And then we would have 356 awarded. Now, 356 out of about 1,600, you know, let's just ballpark it as 400 out of 1,600. So it's about a 25% hit rate. You might say that's pretty reasonable. But then you have to look at the details. Remember that these funds are sort of bucketed, and you might have 40% hit rate in nuclear physics, and you might have 5% hit rate in ERE. So these are some of where the underlying statistics are important to look at. And phase two, it looks like of the roughly 300 Phase 2 applications, we were awarding almost roughly half. So that seems to be high, a little bit high, but in terms of some of the statistics across the program. So what do we do with our beta test, if you will, using the 2009 ARRA SBIR solicitation? We raised the amounts from 100K to 150K, which was statutorily what we could do. And we raised Phase 2 from 750 to 1 million. We increased the weighting on the commercialization of the potential commercialization of the technology from 33% to 50%. And we expanded the commercialization plan requirements for Phase 1, which I hope eventually we will be able to use part, maybe morph to where we could look at doing Phase 1 and Phase 2 at the same time, which is we learned through NIH as a possibility. I liked that idea. And then we set aside $1 million to support the companies that got funded through the National Alliance of Clean Energy Business Incubators and an NREL Industry Growth Forum. They've had a lot of success at bringing companies through this sort of crossing the chasm divide. Other administration changes is that we decreased the Phase 1 cycle time from 9 months to 6 months. And we, from the moment the funding opportunity award hit for this ARRA funding in September, closed in October, we awarded in December and obligated in January. We will then award Phase 2 in April. So we cut a program that would take generally maybe 18 months to get to Phase 2 and a half to about 9 months. We're broadening the topical areas, but we're therefore, just similar to Dr. Gabriel, cutting down on the number of topics so that we won't lose 300 potential innovators and entrepreneurs getting into the net. But what that means is the reason also the topics were more narrowly defined is because we didn't have the staff to process all the applications we'd get. So that seems to be, we need to fix that and figure out how to do that better. And then we're doing an internal SBIR evaluation through case studies, and we also only ran an annual SBIR cycle, so that's kind of tough. If you don't get funded the first year, you may not be around the second year to submit, so we've gone to two cycles a year. Case study with regard to Aminex, a company formed in 1989 to tackle the problem of solar cell degradation. DOE helped fund it to redesign the photovoltaic cell unit, reduce the system cost below $3 a watt, and to achieve an efficiency of 25%. With 70% of the concentrated photovoltaic market, Aminex now is installing around the world in almost many, many companies. And it's grown, I think, again, looking at 15 employees in 2006 to 44 employees in 2009. And it anticipates $5 million in domestic sales in 2010. So I'm sure those numbers of employees have gone up even from then. And again, we're looking for companies that can give us that factor of 10 within a few years' return. Maybe venture capitalists are looking at, you know, a 5X return in 5 to 10 years. We're looking for a 10X return on employee job generation in 5 years. So Phase 1, Phase 2, we were rewarded with 1,000 Phase 1 applications by broadening the number of topics but only having 10 of them. 260 applications sent out for review, and 122 were selected. Phase 2 awards, 122 Phase 2 applications, 61 will be selected. And so I guess thinking through, I'm going to conclude with these slides, is that what we're trying to do is look at how are the different ways that we can give small companies the staying power to be in the game for something like more than 5 years, less than 10 years, because it takes 7 to 12 years to really prove a technology and sometimes get to profitability. So all the different ways of doing that, Phase 1 and Phase 2 give you maybe 3 years. If you put angel funding, their appetite for staying with a venture is sort of 3 to 5 years, especially if you're going to come back to the well a couple times for additional investment. Venture, VC, they're in the capital formation business. They'd like to see that happen in less than 7 years. And then you have the potential for Phase 3 or Phase 2 or some sort of cap program. And now the question is, by themselves, none of these really get across that sort of 10 to 12 year gap, if you will. But in combining them, you see that you get at least, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 opportunities to stack up the different combinations of investment to get you that staying power of over a decade. And then lastly, this was just an example of how long it can take from fundamental discovery of a material. This was Bob Meyer discovered ferroelectricity in liquid crystals in 75 to a company that grew to be acquired in 2005 using some of the basic liquid crystal technology and morphing to a point where all the different ways that it stacked up funding, and one of the ones I want to point out here is the NIST ATP program. This is a company I'm pretty familiar with. The students came up with a fundamental patent in 95. We use that in order to ride an ATP program for $2 million. That's what we view our, what we want to do is have this commercialization fund, sort of the green, so that we can get across the valley of death, get us to where we could prototype things in volume, develop the manufacturing process, so that we could get industrial partnerships, much like Atlantia did, which gave them the opportunity to do their offshore, deep shore drilling platforms. We were able to get a partner called Real D that is doing a lot of the 3D movies, did Avatar, and so this company was acquired by Real D and now does all their R&D with regard to the three-dimensional projection, both the software, the computation, and the materials, and invented the glasses that you wear when you see it. So it was acquired in 2005, and the movie premiere, Chicken Little, happened in, I think, about 2005. So this was a success. But from basic material discovery until fundamentally starting a new industry, the 3D movie, is 30 years. Now, you know, there was a device invention here and eventually a key patent in 95. So from 95 to 2005, that's that decade that these companies need staying power. So that's the lens at which we're looking at the SBIR program in the Department of Energy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Our next speaker is Alan Schaefer, who's, as I said before, is a Principal Deputy Director for Defense Research and Engineering, and has the modest responsibility for coordinating $13 billion in defense RDT&E investments.
Thank you, Tom, and I apologize for being late. We had transportation problems coming over, and I think that there must be, even after you had the transportation problems, there must be every high school student in America here on their field trip this week, because even after that, we ran into more buses. But thank you. I'm glad that I got here in time. I only have one slide, and I have just a few remarks, but I think the value of these types of venues is actually getting into a dialogue after. One of the things that is very, very important and increasingly important to the Department of Defense, and I'm sure that Ken Gabriel hit this very hard, is reaching out to the small innovators. You know, we in the Department of Defense, we're very good at working with the big prime companies who build the big platforms, but increasingly our business is about bringing in innovation and very, very small short-time coordinates. If you think about our traditional in the Department of Defense, traditional development, counter-development cycle, it happened over a year period of decades. When we first started to do manned reconnaissance, we developed high-altitude aircraft. The Soviets then developed the high-altitude SAM. We developed electronic countermeasure. They developed electronic countermeasure. But that sequence played out over a series of decades. With the type of insurgency action we're involved in now, if you take a look at the development cycle of the improvised explosive device, we're in a development cycle that is much, much rapider, the more rapid. The coordinates are on the order of weeks and months, not years. And one thing that I use very often in talks that I give, I ask the audience, how many folks owned a cell phone 15 years ago? And typically, it's not very many. How many folks in this audience owned a cell phone 15 years ago? Actually, that's pretty good. Well, let's go 20 years. 15 years, we're still at about 25% of the audience. So in 15 years, that technology has gone from basically almost no market penetration to being used as a train bomb detonation device for the Madrid train bombings, to being used to detonate IEDs, to being used as command and control by the Mumbai terrorists. So the coordinates that we have to think in are innovation, agility, and speed. I would like to tell you that our big prime defense contractors think in those coordinates. They don't always. So we have to look increasingly to the small businesses for innovation. And we have a family of programs that really starts with CBER Phase 1 and actually the development of our topic areas, but moves into CBER Phase 1. And we find that to be a very, very important part of our portfolio. I'll give you a couple of statistics. Last year within the DOD, and we run two cycles a year, we had over 12,000 proposals for Phase 1 with about 2,000 awards. So that's an awful lot of small business innovation out there. Moving to Phase 2, we down-selected to about 900 awards. So going from Phase 1 to Phase 2, about 40% of our proposers move from Phase 1 to Phase 2. And then typically in any year we have, and it's very hard to get the numbers because there's not a separate funding line, but somewhere between 200 and 400 projects that are active in a Phase 3 development phase. And we think that those are astounding numbers. But we also think that we can do better reaching out to industry. So we've developed some other things, other programs up here. For instance, we have an open business cell. And what that is basically an open website that any developer in a certain area who has an idea can send it in. And the website is www.defensesolutions, one word, .gov. Within that open business cell, we then take a look at the basic proposal, and if there's any type of interest there, we'll marry that small business person up with someone in the government just to start to go through the process of what's the best avenue of approach for that proposer. It could be a direct contract using other transactions. It could be directing the small business to a small business innovative research Phase 1, Phase 2, depending upon how mature the technology is. But we use these different mechanisms to try to reach out and understand where the innovation and understand where the good ideas are coming from. And SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research, is a marvelous program. But what we're finding in the world of innovation and trying to get new ideas in, it's not a one-size-fits-all. So we use the SBIR as one element of a range of possibilities. We also have up here a program called DaVinci, which is the Defense Venture Capital Initiative. It's modeled largely after the intelligence community's InQtel, but again, In a certain specific area, in this case communications, we have a cell of people going out and going to the trade shows, going out to the areas, the hot areas of innovation, and looking for ideas. Now, I won't tell you we fund every possible idea that comes in, but with this open business cell, and we've been running it now for about a year, we have about 40% of the ideas have gone from an idea to let's sit down and talk about developing a proposal, developing a product. 24 of those actually went into proposals that were in some state of funding. And we've had a couple that have actually gone into product development. Now, it's not the same numbers. We're not at the roughly 16% of all ideas that come in go into a project like SBIR's. But we do have a mechanism for reaching out and helping small business shape their proposals. For example, we had one proposal that came in from this open business cell for limb salvage and regenerative medicine. Some bio folks out there who had ideas of how to go ahead and start to regrow damaged tissues. Very, very important for what we're doing and what we're facing right now for the United States. In our fight in Afghanistan and Iraq, taking care of our wounded warriors. So, as I said, going back to the small business innovative research, and I'll mention one other program in this family. You see it in the middle, Tech Transition Initiative, TTI. There is this huge perceived problem of crossing the Valley of Death. I don't get down into the argument of whether the Valley of Death occurs or not. That isn't terribly interesting to me. What's interesting is what can we put in place where good ideas are developed to begin to pull them through to acquisition. And typically we have to work and basically become a matchmaker for a small company with some capacity within the services to buy in large quantity. Now, we had a very good success going from a small business innovative research to a tech transition initiative with a small company called ArmorWorks in Arizona. The company had about 250 people. They were working in high-end ceramics and woven materials for armor protection for soldiers. They ended up coming up and developing the material that was used in the small arms protective or SAPI plates that are used by our soldiers, dismounted infantry on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq. That program went through a small business innovative research phase one to a small business innovative research phase two to a tech transition initiative just to go ahead and try to get a little bit more maturity. And then it went off to a phase three award with the Navy. The phase three funding was about $1 billion for this company. So this is a company who had a good idea, who by using the various instruments ended up hitting out. Not every idea is going to come out with $1 billion capitalization. More often than not, it's a whole lot less than that. But what's important is we used a range of different programs, and I think you heard the same thing from Christina and probably the same thing from Ken. Use a range of different programs to help pull things through very, very quickly. And we used a range of different contracting options. Instead of going out with a standard request for proposal, bid and proposal type of thing, we're using other transactions. So that's basically the message that I wanted to impart on you, that the Department of Defense has to think in terms of innovation, speed, and agility. And we've got to use a range of different products, programs, and projects at the underlying basis of which is small business innovative research to try to get these innovative ideas out for America. And I think with that, Tom, I think the idea is open it up to questions.
Yeah, that's right. So Chuck, just to confirm, we have 45 minutes, or how much time do we have?
Yeah, we usually have half hour.
Okay, super. Okay, I'm going to take the prerogative as a moderator to ask my panelists a couple questions. One is, I think one interesting question is how can agencies identify what are those areas where small businesses are really in a position to make a disproportionate contribution to the mission of your agency. So when you're doing the topic selection, if it's done on too decentralized a basis, you can have the scenario where, you know, there's some program manager who says, well, it's clearly we need new, you know, detectors for high energy physics because that's the problem that he or she happens to work on, as opposed to, okay, you know, our goal is how do we reduce greenhouse gases by 80%? How do we identify those areas where we think that small businesses are in a position to make a really key contribution to a problem that is front and center. So I'd like any of the panelists to sort of address the question of how might we do topic selection on a more strategic basis by identifying the intersection between unique capabilities coming out of the private sector and national and agency priorities.
You don't mind, I'll take a hack at that just because that's actually a true story, right, at DOE. And it's a balance. I mean, the SBIR program does have four different, at least the initial legislation in 1982, said that it's to help engage small business in providing R&D that's needed for the work that's going on. So we do fund exactly that topic area, new detectors in nuclear physics. And there aren't that many companies that do that, and so you know the hit rate's pretty high, and that's one of the reasons. We don't want to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's a question of balance. So I'd like to hear from the other panelists how they do this. But I think that where we're moving to is you really need to have this program become part of the culture of the agency, mm-hmm. and also you need to have the program have enlightened reviewers and you know, you need to take it pretty seriously and have a plan. And I think that's where we're now in the next step of our planning process, is trying to align this program up with the priorities, which include the national interest in terms of being best in the world in science and technology. But that's a key question.
I'll take the next whack, because we have something of a different problem. Within the DOD last year, our SBIR, our total pot for SBIR activity was about $1.25 billion. So we don't spend all that much time trying to neck down the topics. We have 780, last year we had 780 roughly topic areas that we sought for solicitations in. And that's a lot. 12,000 proposals is a lot to go through. But there are two things that I think play on this. One, we have found that by going out and using the kind of the venture capital plumbing companies, conglomerates, the Incutel, the DaVinci, we're able to understand a little bit where industry is going. So we rely on that a lot. We rely pretty heavily on our basic research program in the department, because we have a large number of basic researchers who are kind of tied to the small companies and innovators. But, and this is one of the areas we struggle in, Tom, because we're very large, I'm not sure that I want to try to neck down and focus the topic areas that much, because we have a very good habit in government of over-constraining problems and driving out innovation. Mm-hmm. I want those wild ideas out there that turn into the sappy plates. I want those ideas that are out there that will give us a fourfold increase in fuel cells, because that's exactly outside the conventional wisdom.
Right.
So I think we have to strike a balance. You have to understand what your agency's mission area is, but then I really would worry about being overly constraining. Ken?
I'd like to shift the focus a little bit. While it's important to get it better aligned to what the government needs, I think part of the challenge with running an SBIR program and getting companies to bid is thinking about what it's going to take to help those companies mature, choosing those topics and activities for them to do that's going to help them, for the lack of a better word, grow up, right? Part of the challenge that I think we've seen in SBIR programs, and I'm sure you too as well, you tend to get a group of companies that crack the code on how to get SBIR dollars, and then they get addicted to the crack, right? And they never stop getting SBIR dollars. And they never move on to commercialize and become big. You know, we have some success stories. So it's, in addition to choosing the right topic that serves the government's interest, I think we have to make sure we're choosing topics and activities for the small businesses that are also pushing them up the curve of growing up, going past, whether it's the valley of death or whatever, but getting to become a viable commercial concern that it can survive without government dollars.
Another question I wanted to ask our panelists, and then I'm going to open it up, and that is that Congress is still working on a long-term reauthorization of the SBIR program, and I wondered if any of the panelists had any free advice for our members of Congress as they do that, both with respect to do's and don'ts. One thing that has been mentioned is that currently the program doesn't provide any funding for administration, and certainly a number of the SBIR program managers have said that would be useful. There's also a question about if the Congress were to increase the allocation from, say, 2.5% to 3.5%, would that money be well used, or are you think you're in a situation right now where with the current funding you're able to fund the majority of the meritorious proposals that are coming in? So, any questions? Any helpful hints to our members of Congress?
I will start at great peril. Let me just check, make sure we're under National Academy rules, non-attribution, correct? No press out there?
There is press.
Oh, there is press. Okay.
But it's mainly foreign press.
Well, in that case, we love our foreign comparative test program. Actually, I think I'm comfortable saying this anyways, because I have mentioned this, even though we don't have a formal legislative proposal in the process and everything. One of the things that has always struck me interesting about the Small Business Innovative Research Program is why in phase one, because these are only $75,000 to $100,000 awards, why don't we increase the award at phase one up to $125,000, let's say, but then allocate some portion of that $25,000 for specifically having the small investor have the money to do a market survey to help them understand the commercial landscape in which they're trying to grow up in. So we give these people money, but then we don't help them with the other parts of developing a business that you need. You need to be able to understand your market better. You need to understand who the big players are that could end up helping you, as Dr. Gabriel put it, grow up. So I think sometimes, you know, I don't get involved in the religious argument about whether or not we should allow SBIR funds for administration. I understand why we are where we are. But I really would like us to see and think about a way to help carve out a little bit of money to help the small business think about a little bit better how to be competitive in a commercial market. And that would be a small amount of the total overhead program, but I think it would pay huge benefits.
At peril, I will continue along. So I think that's a great idea. And Charlie Russomano, who I've been working with in EERE, has, you know, put aside from ARA funding money to try and help those companies grow up as well. So I would agree with that. I guess I don't have an opinion, but I throw out, I think that it would be a good idea to have programmatic funds to help support it so we could move forward on some of these issues. I think the other question that has been thrown out is, should companies that have VC funding be able to apply for SBIR? And you know, I've seen both sides of the argument. I know I was involved in a small company from the National Science Foundation, which started with two of my students and grew to 1,000 employees. And the reason it grew is because as soon as they got VC funding, they had to just end their SBIR work and grow up. I mean, it was kind of a dividing point, and I always thought that was kind of unfortunate. But I could see from the VC point of view, they wanted them targeted on these sort of things, and the NSF SBIR was great, and the phase one and phase two was taking it in a little slightly direction. And the VC said, no, we think the big market is over here. So we, you know, finish it off as quickly as possible. So I sort of have two minds about that, and whether we increase from 2.5% to 3.5%, I think there might be already in legislation 0.9% to be used for funding to commercialize activities from the programs, so that we have that option to do that. So again, I don't really have an opinion, more just those would be the issues to think about.
I guess I'd summarize it by saying, if there's a way for us with whatever increase that there might be to make it back-end focused as opposed to front-end focused, right? So increasing the dollars to put more into the early stage, sort of the SBIR phase one, phase twos, while that would help, I don't think that's where you would get the most bang for the buck for the extra that you might put in. And this is totally off the wall, potentially, but one of the most important things to a company is a customer. And that first adopter, that first person who buys your product, in much more than the dollars that you actually get, because they force you, that the seed change in my company that went from prior to shipping our first product and getting our first customer to post was huge. And so to the extent that we can use additional dollars in an SBIR program to be focused on the back end, to be focused on purchasing things from the small company would be huge and would actually amplify whatever dollars we're putting in the beginning. And just a quick sort of perception, part of the reason DARPA, we believe, has been as successful as it has been in getting things out, not only to the DOD, but out to the general economic and commercial sectors, has been that we live within the DOD. And the DOD for DARPA is actually the first adopter, to use entrepreneur speak, right? It's that first customer that you get that validates you, that validates the technology, and therefore can get broader dissemination as a commercial tool. So to the extent that the SBIR program could create that first adopter by additional funds, I think that would be a huge leveraging arm for the program.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to throw it open to the audience, and our actually you were first.
Okay.
So do you want to step up to
sure,
the mic? And if you could please identify yourself, that'd be great.
Hi, Ann Liebschutz, United States Israel Science Technology Foundation. My question's actually a slight variation on the one that Tom opened up with, and I'd like to hear your perspective on what companies can do. It goes to influencing the topic selection process, so whether you have one or two, you know, call for proposals going out a year, to what extent can companies influence how those topics are determined and selected through meeting program managers, meeting with the right points of contacts at agencies? How aggressive can companies be with that to see topics coming out that are consistent with some of the ideas and innovation, potential disruptive solutions that they want to work on?
Very. No, I mean, I think that's really good information for us to know. I think I would really recommend that companies talk to the program managers within all the agencies to so that we can learn what are the problems out in the real world they're trying to address, and therefore, you know, assess them with regard to our own roadmaps and say, yeah, that's an important problem, but it's not going to help us here, or say, yeah, that's an important problem, and we should put funding towards that. I give you a little example of one I just sketched out that may affect the military. We're getting some feedback from DOD that some of our wind turbine farms that are projects that are being proposed may create a shadow for the radar, right, in many areas. So, you know, it seems like that would be a great topic to send out to SBIR as small companies help solve that.
Let's get that open business cell working on that.
I absolutely will just amplify. I mean, the more information small business can give to us about what they're doing, the better off we are. Now, one of the hard parts is the Department of Defense government's very hard to talk to. So one of the reasons we went to our open business cell and the open website is that's the coordinate space that especially the younger entrepreneur thinks in. And they don't have money to travel to Washington to brief us. But if they can go ahead and give us their ideas, so that we can start to work with them in cyberspace to try to shape them, absolutely the most important thing that they can do is let us know what they're working on and how they think it could help us solve our missions.
My name is Jim Jaffe. I'm the president of the National Association of Seed and Venture Funds. And we represent lots of folks who have money, and modest amounts of money that they tend to invest in this arena. And I have two questions for the panel. One is, everybody talks about the valley of death. We have a definition. I'd be very interested in what your definitions are. And second, this may sound a little contrary, but when you're sitting in the positions of the agencies and you have all the money and you're inundated with applications, you may not recognize the fact that there are lots of people, including our members, who are really unaware of how the SBIR process works. And one of the things we'd like to know is how can an organization like ours, a national organization, assist all of you in getting the word out? Because it's very easy when you have 12,000 applications to assume that everybody's aware of what's going on, and the answer is that they're not.
So that was really actually dead on for the topics and the changes that I talked about for DARPA, because that is precisely the sector that we're focused on, the group that we don't even ever see, and we don't know that we never saw. And part of getting them there and seeing them is to make it as business-friendly as possible, as focused on what their needs as opposed to our contracting officers' needs, and to also reach out to the private sector so that we can better articulate what the programs are and what they aren't. Because one of the things that I'm sure some of your folks have voiced are things like government purpose license rights and things that I hear that, you know, the minute you get a government contract, all of your IP is sucked up by the government, and that's obviously going to scare people when it's not true. So, agreed.
Well, Mr. Jaffe, I'd like you to introduce you to Charlie Rusumano back there, and Charlie. And so we would love to connect with you and to be able to give workshops to groups of your, you know, investors in various places to educate on the SBIR program. That would be great. Then the second is, I think there are two valley of deaths, right? There's sort of the valley of death of, in my view, you prototype, you have an idea, you prototype it, you create it, then you bring this thing to a company, a customer, and you say, how would you like it? And they say, well, that's fine. When you can make it in volumes of 1,000 times what you're making now, or 1,000,000 times, and when it can cost 100 times less, come talk to me. And that's that process development. And I think that's a valley of death. You got to create a process by which you can drive costs down and scale up. And that's where we're going to be targeting getting companies across that is developing a process by which we can manufacture in volume. And then there's the other valley of deaths. There's many. This is a hard business.
Thanks, Tom. If I may, just I'd like to congratulate the panel and indeed your leadership, Tom. The focus, the experimentation, the mainstreaming that you're doing in this program is I think really wonderful. I really liked your term allocation. When it's a tax, it's something we have to do that we really don't want to do, and when it's an allocation, it's an opportunity, it's a way. But it's the leadership that drives that process. I'd also just like to refer you to that study where the distinguished committee argued that the program, if expanded, could use the funds effectively, argued more for flexibility and experimentation, and the phase. I'd like to think hard about generating a more rigorously funded phase three, where there's more program funds available to help carry it across. And if you can do that matching in defense, that could be very valuable. I do have some questions, though. One is I wanted to press more on the possibility that you mentioned, Christina, on the reallocation of funds. The physics challenge of 1975 may not be the same thing in 2010, and how to push some of that money across to where you have a higher return. I'd welcome you to exploring that. And in the same vein, pushing on the idea, we discussed this a lot in the committee about an open window, which I think you're, in fact, essentially describing, but a place where you wouldn't have to be tied to the formal solicitations. That has more challenging than it might appear, by the way. I mean, how do you hook that up to things? Who's responsible for it? And lastly, I'd like to...
Only two questions, Chuck.
Okay, fair enough.
Take a quick hack. So, Charles, you reminded me of something in response to your question, Tom, with regard to the amount of funding for the SBIR program. So phase three, you can't use the 2.8% allocation for phase three. And so then it's going to come out of the core programs. And we aren't funding R&D in this country at the level we need to solve some of the major challenges. So that makes it very tough for program managers then to use those funds towards this opportunity. So I'll give you an example. I don't know if you noticed there, but you know the number in our beta prototype of proposals we receive versus the ones we could actually review and allocate, we have about $419 million of proposals that are technically superior, opportunity to create jobs, commercialize technology in the energy field, we cannot fund right now. That's not even phase three. If you then added on the opportunity to have a phase three, you know, my thesis would be that if you could invest, several billion dollars in phase three across the agencies, the return on terms of job amplification and bringing capital off the private sector, you'd get a more of an amplification than in programs where you create a job with, you know, the sort of $92,000 per job. You would be creating the opportunity to create tens of jobs for that investment. So I really think this is something that we have this gem of the SBIR program. We have direct authority in phase three to directly amplify what these entrepreneurs have done in phase one and phase two, and we just haven't been able to use it as effectively as I think we could. So I hope that we can move forward on that in the future.
Dr. Johnson, that was basically my question. I represent the U.S. Advanced Ceramics Association, and the SBIR community, the Valley of Death, often is shortened to phase three. Where's phase three funding? There's been discussion in the policy forums and within agencies in the past about dedicated funding for phase three. In the context of the Recovery Act winding down at the end of the year, is there any opportunity to promote the SBIR backlog of phase two awards for phase, what could be a large pot of funding available for phase three type investments?
You know, I think we have to find a way to do that. I mean, if you look at some of the investments, we invested in the ARA funding, $12.5 billion in energy efficiency. Now, the beauty of that is that's the gift that will keep on giving, right? So if you do the weatherization of $5 billion and in the homes, the low-income families that are going to get the 25 to 30% reduction in their bills and be able to live more comfortably with less money going out per month is a beautiful gift that we'll keep on giving for years. The SBIR program in phase three has the same opportunity just in terms of jobs, high-paying jobs that will bring on supply chain jobs and induce jobs in the community. An investment of the same level as the weatherization program in SBIR would be huge for this country. And I would love to see that happen.
Can I just take just a moment to be a little bit of a contrarian to the last two questions? And I think it would be good to have a little bit more money allocated to the phase three, but I will tell you I worry. And the previous question was, how do you define Valley of Death? You can define it any number of ways, but wherever I see a Valley of Death, it's because there's a mismatch between the developer's expectations and the customer's capability to pull. So if we just allocate dollars to phase three, then I think all you're going to do is slide the Valley of Death to the right, unless you put other types of foundations and conditions on a phase three. Because the beauty of phase three right now is you get a customer who says, I see a product that I want and I'm willing to invest in it. Until you develop that customer demand, and I think, Ken, you said something very similar, until you develop the customer demand, you always run into the real issue of the Valley of Death. So increasing funds available to phase three is a good idea, but we have to set the conditions very, very smartly, or else we're just creating what I would think would be even a worse Valley of Death.
Can I just make a comment? I think that I agree with you. You have to set the conditions, and I agree with you. It's a good idea to look at phase three. What I would do is have a matching. Right now, we look at phase two commercialization as a matching, and I think that at that point, you're probably picking companies that if they've that aren't really able to do the translation. At phase three, you have to have, as you said, some skin in the game from other folks. But if you do that, I think that the reward will be more Armor Works and more Aminix and more.
My name is Eskil Ahlberg from ISIS George Mason University, and we work on how you can trade these ideas and intellectual property for economic growth using experiments. We study what people do in that sense. So my question here to all the panel, some of you have touched on it a little bit, and is how are you helping out in this sort of matchmaking in these transactions where the agents are specialized? You have inventor who are very different in the nature to the next step you pointed out, patents, for example, which is another kind of skill. And then you have the developers, which are yet another kind of skill. So these are very different. And at some point in time, earlier than later, you have to understand the customer. And that is typically a hard thing for the people in the front end. And I'd like to challenge Dr. Gabriel, well, the front end may be the customer end and not the back end. That thinking about the problem in that way maybe is helpful. But my question is the matchmaking story. Is this something that you're helping with so that these different skills can come together and create this growth?
So, of course, the customer has to be considered very early on. My use of the word customer is in the back end is more about the growth of the company. And there is nothing that focuses a company more than having a customer that you have to deliver a product to. And that's the sense in which putting them, that's what I mean by the back end and the growth of the company getting to that point. I would say in terms of your specific question about what we do for matchmaking, we don't do anything for the matchmaking, frankly. I mean, the programs are there to put objectives, particular topics out, and the teams come together. We at DARPA don't do anything specifically for matchmaking.
Is that something you could do? I agree with your point that the customer is important.
I suspect we could do it. I'm not so sure in the pantheon of all the things that we would do for a company, potentially, it would be I personally would say we should focus on reducing the time from 6 months to less than 30 days for you to get contracted, to make the contract simpler, clearer, and fairer so that you don't have any constrictions when you go to private. That will do, I believe, if I could choose between those two versus matchmaking as an entrepreneur, I'd take the first two.
Chuck Cole, Baradine Research, and a member of the NRC SBIR Steering Committee. Christina, you showed a Pastor's Quadrant inspired two-dimensional plot, and I'd like to suggest that I think trying to expand on Tom's original question and Alan's response, I think we need to think about another Pasteur quadrant type plot. In terms of topics, which you discussed, I think we're all aware, particularly in DOD, that the scope of the topics goes from very narrow incremental technological innovation to very open topics, and the open topics have been defended with, and I think quite rightly, but there's a vertical axis which I'd like to suggest needs some more specific attention, which is the risks to payout possibility. And we've discussed within the committee without making any specific recommendations so far, but I think we have a broad support for it, that at least a portion of each agency's projects should be phase one should be looking for very high risk but very high potential payout, because we have a problem in all of our R&D programs, and certainly not just the SBIR in this country, where whoever is doing the reviewing almost always is more in favor of a sure but modest payout over a much less sure but potentially a much larger payout. So in the committee, we've actually said it would be a great idea if a fraction, maybe a small fraction, but a fraction of the awards went to very high risk but very high potential payout proposals.
And do you think that there are a lot of those high-risk, high-payoff ideas where you can demonstrate for $100,000 that you can really make a lot of progress? I mean, a lot of the programs that we're using to support high-risk, high-payoff, sort of a condition of them is that the government is going to provide some sustained support. So, for example, if you look at the way that NIH is doing this, they're making larger bets on individuals, and they're giving them 5 years of funding at a much larger rate. So the question I have is, do you think there are a large class of really high-risk, high-payoff ideas where giving a small business $100K is enough of a runway to demonstrate that they really have something?
Well, I think there is, but I'm an experimentalist by training, and so, you know, I would suggest an experiment. I would point out the National Science Foundation, which doesn't have mission problems in general, so should be free to do this kind of experiment, actually does have does empower their program managers to make roughly 50 to 100K one-year grants without going out for extensive peer review on exactly this kind of thing. Now, as somebody who's led a committee of visitors reviewing what the program managers actually do, they don't do this very often. And maybe the NSF has some valuable information for other R&D programs about how to structure this to be more successful. But at least at the NSF, they've had a program for many years where they allocate about that amount of money and about that amount of time, and I believe they've had some significant successes from that.
Hi. Just make one quick comment. So ARPA-E, the Advanced Research Project Agency for Energy, is really in that kind of mode of the high risk, high payoff, high reward, short 3-year program. So I think that that is something that we're trying to do. It's a little outside of SBIR, but we are trying to link the two programs together. So look at funds that weren't funded by ARPA-E. Maybe they'd be eligible for SBIR.
Well, I think you know the one problem that small businesses perceive with ARPA-E is the statutory price cost sharing, which is very which is a real challenge. I know you've heard this already from.
Yeah, it's about 20%.
Right.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kevin Wheeler, and I'm with the Senate Small Business Committee, and we struggle with these issues. Hi, nice to finally meet you. And Dr. Johnson had made a comment that firms with VC are no longer allowed to participate in the SBIR program, and we spend a lot of time trying to educate people, and they actually are eligible. It's only once they become majority owners, the firms, that they can't participate. And then I heard Dr. Gabriel, is it Dr. Gabriel, make a comment, and it was about how do we get firms to commercialize more? They stay in the program forever. And are you talking about mill riders there? Right. People who stay in the program? Or
I'm just talking about the programs where people, as a result of taking the SBIR dollars, stay in that SBIR sort of mode of fulfilling the requirements of the SBIR contract, as opposed to using it as a mechanism to create products and get out into the marketplace. Some of the things that Al was talking about, using it to create a market study or better define what their product are. So it's just that in the experience in the past and when I was out in the private sector, so for example, with my company, I specifically never took a single SBIR dollar at all. Not because I wasn't familiar with the program, not because I didn't know how to go after it, is it would have actually created a bifurcation in the company, if you will, and not had us continue to be focused on developing a product. I'm not necessarily saying bad or good. That was just a personal choice. But let me jump back to your first comment about how VC limitation only applies to companies that are 50% owned. By the time you get your A, many companies, even with an A round or with a B round, definitely they will have more than 50% ownership by that venture capital firm. So while it may not sound like it's very limiting, it in fact will basically take care of any company that gets outside funding.
But actually, when GAO looked at this, comparing the 2 years before the clarification and the 2 years after, firms, SBIR firms that got VC, it grew. At NIH, it grew from 14% to 22%, and at DOD, it grew from 5% to 7%.
I'm sorry, what grew?
The amount of firms with VC who were getting SBIR firms, it actually went up.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
After they clarified that those were majority-owned, could not participate.
Sure. And that helps. I'm sure it does. Clarification helps that. But all I'm saying is that once you get, it's not that hard to become 50% owned by venture capital.
But it doesn't keep, it actually, firms with VC actually did better after the clarification. They were getting a larger share of the SBIR dollars afterwards. So there were still firms participating.
Okay. I believe that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Okay. So on the commercialization and where do you go, I guess from our standpoint, policy-wise, on the Hill, we feel that the agencies are very different. And so some are acquisition and some are not. And so we don't know, we don't view commercialization as only a product getting to market. It could be that DOD buys something. Many companies have a model that they license and they get out. So we see the success is not so black and white for the commercialization in order to account for the different agencies and the different technologies.
What I use the term product and commercialization very broadly Some companies are focused on commercializing, licensing their IP. That's nevertheless still a product that's customer-focused as opposed to generating it through the SBIR dollars.
Okay.
So that's what I mean. It's not a particularly a widget, but the focus on the people who are going to pay you something to deliver them something.
But as you, as head of DARPA, you're not taking it where you would only consider it a success if they had a product. So.
Of course not.
Good.
The only, and okay. I'm not even defining. I don't want to narrow down who is a success and who isn't a success. The only thing I'm focused on are the things that I believe we can influence that are of most importance to a company, which is make the contracts as simple as possible, get them under contract as quickly as possible, and get them the money with as little constraints as possible, and let them do whatever they need to do to become successful. Period.
Okay.
We've got time for two more quick questions. So no multi-part questions.
All right. I'm Joanne Goodnight, and I'm the program manager for NIH's SBIR and SDTR programs. It's too bad Dr. Johnson left, because I do have one question, but I just want to give a point of clarification for those who don't know that as of March 30th, the SBA actually released an announcement that the Phase 1 and Phase 2 amounts increased to $150,000 and $1 million for Phase 1
Correct.
And Phase 2, respectively. So the agencies still have the flexibility to exceed that, but we were glad to see that happen. I want to come back to the comment about the who are we missing in this universe? And I think it all points to the need to incentivize more companies to participate. By increasing the award amounts, that does one thing. By looking at eligibility criteria, that may be another. A lot of the agencies are incentivizing more companies because they're putting in these Phase 2B programs. NIH has one we offer, and this gets back to Tom's point about a total of 5 years of funding. We offer a Phase 2 competing renewal program providing up to $1 million per year for up to 3 years. So they still have to get the Phase 1, then they have to get the Phase 2, but that valley of death is very long in the biomedical research pathway. And so that extra infusion of R&D funding, we believe, is helping to position those companies for attracting venture capital. We encourage the venture capital or other investments. A lot of states are providing that. And right now, for an agency who's not buying, our commercialization rate is about 50%, which is pretty darn good. So the question is, because it ties back to the incentives, we have this technical assistance clause that allows agencies to set up commercialization assistance programs. It provides for $4,000 per year per award. So how are your agencies utilizing that, and what might you change if you were king for the day in terms of that technical assistance opportunity?
I honestly don't know the answer to the question, so I'm going to take a pass because I don't know.
Are you using the technical assistance clause?
As I just said, I don't know.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you didn't know how you might change
no.
it or if you whether
no.
you're using it.
We are not using that clause. As I said, what I focused initially on is not to say that I wouldn't. Look at something like that as, for the agency, but the things that I wanted the agency to focus on was the contracts, the simplification of the contracts, clarification of the contracts, and making a significant dent and going from a typical 5 to 6 months until you get your money to less than 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, again, as an entrepreneur, if I put myself in the seat, would I rather have $4,000 in helping commercialization or get my money 4 months earlier? I'll take my money 4 months earlier. Now, once I solve that problem and it's routine, then I'll take. Now that you're giving me my money in less than 60 days, yes, I'd like some help in addition to that. But first fix the arterial wound and then let's help me with the other stuff.
Thanks.
Okay, my name is Ashok Shukla from Glygen Corporation. We are a very small biotech company here locally. And what we see, that Dr. Gensler was telling 80% SBIR academic people involved. I say 100% because all the SBIR academic, there are 20% who left the academic and started a company, or the people who are in the university, a job, and they write a grant. But it's very difficult for a small company to compete in the grant where the professor or anybody in the involved in the grant, polishing the grant, a small company is day-to-day, so much to do, had not so much time to write the grant. Is some way provision that people can send new idea to the program director or program manager and see that whether it is applicable or not before they start writing the grant?
I think that that is part of what we're trying to do with our open business cell. Now, what I don't know, and that's the open business cell is an experiment, and we're trying to help shape it. What I don't know is how it will scale to a large number of areas, whether we'll have to have separate cells, how many people it will take. But, yeah, I mean, we want to work with small companies and help you shape your ideas so you don't waste your time and you don't waste ours.
Yeah, because most of our small company, 10 around that, it's very difficult to write a month or 2 months to polish the grant, and there's some mistake is small and the grant is never read and came back, and we get frustrated and we say, drop the idea, work somewhere, get 100,000 in the business somewhere else and do the business. And that way I say we have a lot of small company have good ideas. If there is some way provision can make non-academic to academic companies, it can help a little bit in place of polishing the grant.
Well, please join me in thanking our terrific panel.